Welcome back to the Wise Athlete Podcast. Today, in episode number 53, I spoke with Dr. Adam Patena, a NHS medical doctor and the chief medical officer of Span Health, about the use of wearable biometric devices to help older athletes identify low-hanging fruit for big improvements in health and athletic performance. As I am a generally unsatisfied user of such devices, as well as a chronic experimenter, I was delighted to have the help of a medical expert to cut through the marketing BS to get at what really are the useful tools and metrics to use to understand my health and fitness, and whether my efforts to improve them are working. Dr. Patena and I discuss, why do we need continuous tracking of anything? What are the useful biometric devices that can provide insight into health and fitness? And a deep dive into sleep tracking, activity tracking, heart rate and HRV tracking, as well as continuous blood glucose tracking, all of which fall into the areas that Dr. Patena believe give the older athlete the best return on investment of time and money. All right, let's talk to Dr. Patena. Dr. Adam Patena, welcome to the Wise Athletes Podcast.
Thanks, Joe. Thanks for having me.
Adam, the focus of the Wise Athlete Podcast is the older athlete and how we can improve athletic performance today and retain our athletic capability for a long time. As a group, we are big users of performance tracking tools like heart rate, power output, speed, and distance. And more, we are now adding these biometric tracking wearables for general health and fitness tracking as well, you know, things like sleep duration, HRV. As a longevity doctor who is also working in the wearables market, I believe you are just the right person to help us understand where this market is right now. What are the capabilities of these devices currently? Although I know they're getting better and better. And also then, for now, how can we get the most cost-effective usage of them? What do you think, Adam? Can you help us with this?
I'll try my best. I mean, that's interesting, Joe, because that's actually my main interest is kind of how can we improve performance and longevity in that age group? Because it's pretty easy when you're in your 20s to you know, hit all the markers and be feeling good about yourself. But where you really have to put some work in is, you know, unfortunately, after a certain age, you'll need to start putting the work in and actually looking at your metrics. And that's where I think the knowledge in this space can actually have an impact.
Right. Yes. I'm glad to have you here to help us think through that. I think that before we dive in, and just trust me, I got a ton of questions for you. But before we dive into that, I think it would be helpful to our audience to really have a better understanding of who you are, you know, where your knowledge comes from, what are you doing now? I heard that you are a longevity medical doctor. Tell us
so
what
there's,
that is.
There's no such thing as a longevity medical doctor kind of okay. Officially, right? But because it's kind of a new field. So I'm a medical doctor by training. My official training is in internal medicine, and I did some training in oncology as well. So that's kind of my actual medical training, but my interest has always been in longevity and how can we, and I call it applied longevity. So how can we translate what's going on in the longevity research into applied actionable tools that can impact our lives? And it's more about prevention of age-related diseases and also kind of keeping our health optimally optimized, you know, as long as we can. So my interest in this kind of led me to start a company in this space, which is called Span Health, and where we kind of provide longevity coaching. Now, it's interesting because there is no specialty that actually teaches a doctor how to, you know, manage the space of longevity. So it's kind of now there are like certain pockets and certain a bunch of different doctors all around the world who are doing a lot of research and doing a lot of work in this space. And it's becoming a bit of a community outside of the traditional medical establishment.
Yeah, that's great. My questions, let me go through this. We've got a lot to talk about. And let me get some input from Glenn as well. And Glenn, good morning, by the way.
Well, good morning to you, Joe and Adam.
Yes. Welcome back. Glenn had missed the last few episodes because of being out ill.
I was getting my natural vaccine from coronavirus.
Yeah, the best kind. Good best for kind. You. as long as you get through that process, right, that's the best. So the things that I thought we'd go through, and you tell me what you think, and if you want to change the order, is one would be, let's just start off by, why do we want these things? Why do we need these continuous tracking of anything? Why is it my annual physical with my family doctor who gives me a blood test and says, oh, this is high or this is low? Why isn't that good enough? Then more of an overview of this marketplace, this wearables marketplace, you know, like what are the different kinds of devices that are out there that are not just all hype? And I understand that there's also software services that sit on top of these wearable devices that sort of bring all the data together. And then if you could give us your assessment of, you know, what is the status of these things, you know, the things that are legit and good and useful right now and things that are up and coming, and keep your eye on them because they will be really soon. And maybe we don't have time to go into all of the stuff that we just don't need to spend our money on. And then I'd like to be sure to get into your thoughts on this sort of 80-20 rule, this how can I focus my money and my attention on the things that are going to give me the biggest bang for my buck? If something is super accurate, but if I manage to optimize my behavior on that thing, it has no effect on my athletic performance, my longevity, well, then that's not really very helpful. On the other hand, something that might not be totally accurate, but if it's directionally right and I can make changes to my behavior and it has a big effect on my fitness and on my longevity, well, then maybe that's worth spending some time with and some money on.
Yeah.
So I'm really anxious to get to that. And the first part of it that I was thinking is really just sort of a prelude to then getting your advice on that. What do you think? Did I miss something?
That sounds awesome. Yeah, that's right down my alleyway. So.
Awesome. Well, let's get into it then. And Glenn, does that sound good to you?
Sounds perfect. I'm really looking forward to this. This is really good.
Excellent. Glenn was showing everybody his collection of devices, and I was showing some of mine as well. So we are definitely believers in some of this technology. So getting Adam on the podcast was a big coup for us. Let's start with why we need continuous anything. Why once a year tracking isn't good enough?
Yeah, I think there's a continuum there because, as you said, once a year tracking is kind of giving you a snapshot of what's going on once a year. And that can be really useful for things that don't change very rapidly. But the more granularity we have, the more we can measure metrics that actually do vary from one day to another, or from one month to another, or even in shorter spans than that. And then that can give us more information that we can use to improve our health and reach our goals. But there is kind of a point where we reach, with certain metrics, I think there is a point where we reach a kind of a turn, a point of diminishing returns.
Yeah.
And I think that is different from one person to another. And it's also different depending on your goals and your age. So I think there is some personalization there to what is the right amount of measuring that you should be doing and that you can kind of use.
Okay. All right. Well, that's fair. Let's get into then your overview of this wearables marketplace. Can you tell us what's out there and how it's sort of the different parts are kind of evolving and fitting together to be this add-on to what we do with our doctors once a year?
Yeah, I mean, let me give an example of this. So it used to be where, or it's still the kind of gold standard, is when you have diabetes, or to screen for diabetes, you do this test called HbA1c,
yeah,
which I'm sure you might have done in the past. And HbA1c gives you kind of an average of your blood sugar levels over the last 3 months.
Yeah.
Now, why this is useful is because if you measure your HbA1c every 3 months, every 6 months, it can give you an idea if your average blood sugar is going up. But once it starts showing up on HbA1c, that means your blood sugar has been up for the last 3 months at least.
Yeah.
Now, it would be probably a good idea to know earlier than that your blood sugar is kind of behaving in a way that you wouldn't want it to be. Now, the only way to do that would be to get more granularity by continuous glucose monitoring.
Yeah.
and measuring. So that's where new measurements such as glucose variability come into play, which measures the, not really the average blood sugar levels, but the how much it's oscillating from an average.
Yeah.
And that's actually an earlier measure that gives us an indication that there's something going on there that we need to pay attention to. People know diabetes, they've heard of pre-diabetes, but this is a continuum of kind of metabolic dysregulation that can start even before we know that we're pre-diabetic. And that's where I think that's a really good example of where wearables can be an early warning sign and can give us an indication that there's something going on. And another side to wearables is that it can close the loop of building a new habit faster. So this is a framework of habit formation, which is it's called a habit loop, which starts with an indication or something that nudges us to start
some
the action.
Trigger.
Yeah, a trigger. And then you do the action itself. And then after that, if you receive a reward, that's kind of the loop that you go through in order to form a habit.
Yeah.
Now, usually, and you guys have probably talked about this a lot, but when you're trying to develop an exercise habit or training habit, you'd want to go through that loop as fast as possible. And if you wait until you see a change in your performance, a visual change in your, for example, in your appearance, or a change in your performance that is perceived, without wearables, you're probably waiting for a longer time before you close that loop and you receive that reward of improved performance. But whereas when you're using a wearable, you can potentially close that loop faster because you see that improvement faster, and that will translate into building a new habit.
Right.
And that's how those two applications, I think, are very important when it comes to wearables.
Good. So tell us where this market is, the kinds of devices that are available to us and the ones that with enough time and experience has gone into them and testing so that we know that they're reliable and useful.
Yeah, I mean, as you said, as we were talking about earlier, 10 years ago, we only had kind of step counts, and then we had, heart rate, and that was kind of it. Now, I think the market is really exploding, and the technology is improving so fast that within one single device, like a ring or a band, you can have multiple measurements that give you a wide array of different biometrics. So the way I think about it is, or the way we've categorized it at SPAN, is we look at metrics related to sleep, exercise, and nutrition.
Okay.
But I think a layer on top of that would be looking at different organs and different biomarkers that are related to different organs. So things like, so if we talk about sleep, nutrition, and exercise, when it comes to exercise, heart rate variability, resting heart rate, VO2 max, these are all kind of exercise-related metrics. Then when it comes to sleep, obviously total sleep time, sleep stages, a less well-known metric, which is called wakefulness after sleep onset. These are kind of key metrics that we look at.
Yeah.
And then we can look at nutrition-related or metabolic-related metrics, such as glucose levels. And then we can have the traditional BMI, height and weight. And also, we can add to that body fat percentage, and that can give us kind of a pretty good, overview of where we are kind of health-wise. And then all of that information can be used to find where are the low-hanging fruits where we can actually start working and improving our health. And all of this is available now in consumer devices.
Well, I mean, one of the problems is that there's no one thing that captures everything. And so you've got to have, a ring for this set of things and a strap on your wrist for that set of things. And there's an overlap and they don't agree. How do we deal with all of this stuff? I mean, because it may be that one is accurate and one is not. It may be that neither one of them is accurate. It may be that they're accurate, but they're on different parts of the body. And that means that the data is different. And, how do we reconcile this thing and actually come to knowing what to do? I mean, I'll tell you that most of the people that I interact with do not have time. They don't spend most of their day looking at their metrics and trying to make assessments of how they're going to change their behavior in order to get their metrics. You know, they just don't, they don't have time for it, or they won't make the time for doing that. So they need, I don't know, they need something to tell them, do this, these two things. Those are the two things that'll have the most effect, or, you know, some general advice that'll have the most effect.
Yeah, that's a big problem. And actually, one of the things that I hear most from people who kind of, one of the negative aspects of this whole area is that people don't have the time to understand all of this data or to know what to measure. And my answer to that is usually to kind of outsource this to someone else who does know all of that. Now, for the first problem is, you know, what wearables should I be measuring and what metrics should I be looking at? And this kind of differs from one person to another, depending on their goals and also depending on where the low-hanging fruit is. So if you feel like you don't have a problem with sleep, your sleep is not the main area you want to focus on, then probably focusing on getting a device that, you know, is sleep focused isn't probably the right way to go. If you have, if you feel like your nutrition and, you know, you want to lose weight, you want to work on that aspect, then there's a different device for that. And the same thing goes for if your focus is on performance or athleticism. So I think that would be the first step. And then the second step would be to outsource that data to someone who will be able to understand that data and give you the insights and recommendations that can help you improve your health.
So that, like a coach?
Yeah. So a coach, exactly.
Okay. But there are also services that are coming up now to address this specific question, I think, that will take the data from various devices and then try to make sense of it. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, I think the tracking itself is kind of gone so far, but the what to do with the data is still kind of is still lagging behind. Okay. So there's like the tracking of health metrics, and then there's the care side of what do we do with these, and kind of the implications and the recommendations that we can base on these metrics. And I think that's what's lagging behind now, and that's kind of the solution that we're trying to build on top of the layer of all this information. And So I think the solution to that is kind of to outsource all of the information that you're gathering about yourself to someone who is an expert who can give you the insights that matter. And another thing, aspect of this is that gathering a lot of data and not knowing what to do with it can be counterproductive, really.
Well, if you're trying to lower your stress, it sure can be.
Exactly, exactly. And a big part of this is managing your stress. And if you're just adding to your stress by trying to understand all of these data points, then you're probably, it might be a net negative.
Yeah, yeah. All right. In order to make this actionable, most of the people listening here are using something. You know, they got an Apple Watch or something. And they're probably not going to go hire a coach to help them learn how to interpret the results of their Apple Watch. But just to make this actionable, I wonder if we could maybe touch on some common things, right? We can't speak to any individual person, but we can speak to some common situations that you've encountered.
Let's do it. What are your metrics like right now? What are you working on?
Well, shoot, man, I am working on a lot of things. Yeah, well, hit me, but these are not all issues currently, but they have been issues, and some of them are current issues. Sleep. As I've gotten older, I went from being a person who could sleep at any time, anywhere, for as long as I was allowed to, and I evolved into a person who desperately had to find ways to go to sleep earlier because I was getting up really early every day, no matter how tired I was. So not getting enough sleep was definitely one of my problems.
That's interesting because you said that you didn't have a problem falling asleep, but you would wake up early and you feel like you weren't getting enough sleep, and that was kind of taken out of your later or the second half of your night, right?
Partly true. It was I had to find a way to fall asleep earlier because I was getting up earlier. So in order to try to get enough sleep, I had to force myself to go to sleep before I really wanted to, because I knew I was going to get up before I wanted to.
But why were you getting up? Was that because of kind of
stress?
You had to wake up, or you just woke up on your own?
Well, I'll tell you, I just woke up on my own. Did I wake up on my own thinking about work? Yeah, sometimes. You know, did I wake up because I had to go to the bathroom? Well, you know, I sure had to go to the bathroom, but did I wake up because I had to go to the bathroom, or did I have to go to the bathroom because I woke up? I don't know the answer to that. I would say that that is less of a problem now because of a couple of things. One is that I have sort of backed off of all of the different supplements I was taking to try to help me to fall asleep better. Melatonin being one that I used to take really crazy doses, now that I think of it, you know, but I'd heard it was good for me and why not? It's natural. And I was taking more and more because, of course, that's what the size of the pills came in, right? I wasn't thinking I had to break them up. But now I take very small doses, a third of a milligram.
Yeah.
In a time release dose. And then the other thing that I have been doing, just released a podcast last week on nasal breathing. Well, I have been trying, and with some success, succeeding to nasal breathe while I sleep. And I just, in the last week, because of that podcast, added the nasal strip, the breathe right strips over the nose. And that turned a switch for me. I am now a great sleeper. I sleep through the night. If I get up in the middle of the night, which still does happen, I go right back to sleep. I'm not getting up until, you know, instead of getting up at 3 a.m, I'm definitely not getting up until 6, 6:30. I'm getting a ton of sleep now.
That's really interesting. That's the next thing I was going to ask you. And actually, some people, I mean, this is anecdotal. There's not real, it's not really supported by evidence, but mouth taping seems to help a lot with people kind of to train yourself to breathe through your nose. So it's basically a tape that you use on your mouth, and it prevents you from mouth breathing during the night.
Yeah, yeah. The thing that I still look at, and now that I have an Oura Ring, which somehow likes how I sleep better than all of the other things that I've used in the past, my Oura Ring shows that I get a ton of deep sleep and a ton of REM sleep. I mean, like, weirdly large amounts. Maybe you could just speak in general if the person listening's device says that they're not getting enough sleep, or their sleep stages, you know, they're getting very little deep sleep, or something like that. What would you think they would do about that?
Yeah, to put those two kind of topics together, there are three kind of general problems with sleep, and using devices can help us put our problem into one of these three categories. Either we're not sleeping enough, so total sleep time is short, or we're waking up after, you know, getting 8 hours of sleep, but we're not feeling refreshed, so that means our quality of sleep isn't that good, or we have trouble falling asleep, which is kind of like insomnia. And there are things that we can do to help us fall to sleep faster. And the way these devices can help, so for example, Oura Ring does sleep stage detection, and there's two types of sleep detection. There's two-stage and four-stage sleep detection. Two-stage sleep detection differentiates between wakefulness and being asleep. That's it.
Yeah.
And that's very accurate when it comes to different devices, especially Oura. I think it's 96% on the new generation.
Pretty good.
To detect, you know, whether you're asleep or not. Now, where it becomes a bit less accurate, and which previous devices have actually been pretty bad at detecting for sleep detection. So, yeah, differentiating between light sleep, deep sleep, REM sleep. The new Oura Ring claims to have a 79% accuracy there. And the way we measure accuracy is when you compare it to polysomnography, which is kind of a lab-based gold standard test.
And that's measuring brain waves?
Exactly, looking at brainwaves changes throughout the night, and also heart rate changes and different things. And the way Oura Ring detects it is looking at a few different things. So they look at heart rate, the way the heart rate changes, but it also looks at HRV, and it uses different algorithms to kind of give you the final measure. And it's 79% accurate.
Probably it looks at movement.
Yeah, movement as well. So I think, first of all, if you have a problem with sleep, you need to look at your total sleep time,
yeah,
and work on that. Even if you're not getting enough deep sleep or REM sleep, because I think that's more accurate. So that's where you want to work on first. And then if that is fine and you're not waking up a lot during the night, so that's another thing, which is kind of a number of awakenings and also minutes spent awake after falling asleep. Yeah. Problem is that when we wake up in the morning, we don't really remember how many times we woke up during the night accurately. Because you do wake up, but you're not fully alert to the point where you're going to remember when you wake up in the morning. So that's where devices can actually help a lot. So that would be the first thing to work on. And then after that, once you kind of solve that, if your deep sleep or REM sleep is low, then you can start working on those. And working on REM sleep is usually working on your latter half of the night sleep. Yeah. So in your case, for example, or like in anyone's case, if someone is waking up at, say, like 4 a.m., 5 a.m., and they feel after like 6 hours or 5 hours of sleep and they feel like they haven't gotten enough sleep, then maybe that's something that you need to work on, and maybe there's something there. And sometimes it's something as simple as ensuring darkness in the morning or in the early hours of the morning, or ensuring that there's no noise, or temperature can be another thing, because our body temperature drops a lot during that period. Right. And if the environment isn't helping your body drop your core temperature, that can lead to disturbances in the latter half of the night, which can lead to not getting enough REM sleep. So yeah, these are all of this is the kind of sequence where I would use to go through my data.
Right. One of the problems that I think that people have is they stay up too late.
Yeah.
That was always my problem. I think what was happening is that I was fighting through my normal early melatonin, and I was just staying awake because I was really good. I had learned fantastic skills as a young person, as a student, as a young professional, to be able to stay alert when I was really tired. And so I was really great at that. And so I then would go to bed after I'd already burned through some of my sleep chemicals in my body, so that when I hadn't gotten enough sleep yet, those chemicals ran out and I started shallowing out in my sleep, and now other things outweighed it.
That's a really good point, because we actually are very bad at knowing if we've gotten enough sleep, just like looking by our energy levels and the way we feel.
Yeah,
there's interesting research on this. The Japanese sleep studies are fantastic. Some of these Japanese sleep studies are really good. And one of my favorite ones is where they bring in a number of people and they ask them, do you feel like your sleep is suboptimal? And it doesn't matter if they said yes or no. Even the people who were sleeping 7.5 hours, they felt like they're sleeping well. When they put them in a lab setting where they could sleep for 12 hours, all of them overslept. So that means they had sleep debt accumulated. And it doesn't matter if you felt like your energy levels during the day were suboptimal. Some of them felt like their energy levels were great. And the interesting part is, after they were allowed to sleep well, and took them 4 nights of good sleep to repay the sleep debt that they've accumulated, right? And so 4 nights on average to repay 1 hour of sleep debt. But the interesting part is, after the first night of good sleep, their energy levels went up and they felt like they've repaid all their sleep debt. But when they looked at their physiological markers and their blood markers, there was still some disturbances there that weren't resolved until a week later. So what's kind of happening is your body is kind of overcompensating to make you feel normal, but it's actually working kind of harder on the inside to overcompensate for the lack of sleep that you're getting.
Yeah. Well, so the lesson there to me would be, don't think you're recovering from one bad night of sleep by having one good night of sleep. Or what I always used to do, which I know for a fact never worked, was I would try to recover on the weekends.
Yes.
I try to, you know, catch up on the weekends. Well, that's 2 days versus 5 days. And you were saying the other way, one versus four. So there was no way that was ever going to work.
Yeah, you're never going to catch up on the weekends. And it takes way longer than that for your physiology to go back to normal. And that's really, you know, what's more important here.
Yeah. So that's just added stress on top of normal life stress, on top of exercise stress. That's just wearing you down and keeping you from being as fast on the bike as you want to be. So get your sleep worked out. Okay. So that was great. Let's talk about metabolic issues. And we can talk about me again, because I come from a long line of people with metabolic problems. Every single man in my family line that I'm aware of had type 2 diabetes eventually. And I have periodically bumped into that, oh, you've got pre-diabetes, this is inevitable, it's progressive, you're going to have it eventually, all you can do is slow it down. Well, by God, I've been doing everything I can to slow it down, and I don't even believe what they say. So don't tell me if I should believe it, because I'm just fighting it tooth and nail. And so one of the things that I did was the CGM.
Yeah.
You know, they had one of these programs where you could do it for a month, and it was really kind of a crazy scheme that they had going, where it cost me an unbelievable amount of money to do, but I could earn it all back by being good, right? If my okay. blood sugar was below a certain threshold and I didn't spike, then I would make money back from the huge amount of money I had to pay in. And so by God, I got back every penny I could. Unfortunately, what that meant is I couldn't really experiment, because I knew the things that I really wanted to do to try to see, well, what would this do and what would that do? I was afraid that it would spike me and then I would lose my money. And so that kind of a program wasn't good for me. But let's talk about metabolic health.
Yeah, so it's really difficult to get a good snapshot of metabolic health from wearables like CGM, because that only gives us a part of it. So I need to be a bit rigorous here and not say that just lowering your blood glucose spikes is always good, because there is a normal variation that we can see in normal people of blood glucose spikes. So it's not all about just keeping those blood spikes to a minimum. So I'm not like, you know, a keto proponent all the time. But it can give us a lot of information of what's going on. And the way we kind of think about it is, if you do a CGM program for 2 weeks or a month and you follow your normal diet, and then that can allow you to see what in your normal diet is spiking your blood glucose above a certain range. And then you can start experimenting by finding alternatives that can give you the same satiation, the same feel, but will give you a lower blood glucose spike. And that will be by identifying types of food, but also quantities that give you that spike. So for example, if you wake up in the morning and you're usually, you know, you have a bowl of Greek yogurt and granola and some fruit, right? So in an ideal world, you would plot these in a table and say, I had this much of granola, this much of yogurt, and this much of fruit. And then you can correlate that with the spike of blood glucose. And then you can start experimenting by having the granola alone and having the yogurt alone and having the fruit. And then you can identify where that spike actually came from. And then you can start finding replacements for that. And once you've done that with everything that you eat on a regular diet, then you've gotten most of the benefit from the CGM. That's when you can use those kind of insights for the rest of your life. So I think it's worth doing at least for a few weeks.
Yeah, I did find it, you know, for all my complaining, I did find it useful. One thing that, sort of the biggest thing that I discovered was that I had these protein bars that I bought from Costco that I just loved them. I mean, I was addicted to them. I loved the taste of them. I'm a protein person. So I always felt like I was getting healthier, you know, every stupid bar that I ate. And those things shot my blood glucose, even though it was like no net carbs, right? It was all these weird flavors in there that, to make them taste good. It was an undigestible things that would keep the net carbs really low. Yeah. My blood sugar went crazy. And so I had to give them up. But I never would have given up that addiction without that feedback. So there is valuable information there. The problem with those CGM things is that they're not really easy to get if you're not a diabetic. you've got to sign up for these programs, and it's awfully expensive to do these things. Do you really need to do, would you say? I mean, can you just feel it? For example, me as a person who is like a pre-diabetic person who, you know, has it in family history, I mean, it's definitely a risk factor for me.
Yeah.
And I have tried, I've done keto, and I've gone away from that. And to keep Glenn from shouting at me, I won't say anything bad about keto. But what I have done is I've shifted my diet to help me to be metabolically flexible. So I want to eat carbohydrates and have the energy from carbohydrates, but I try to match that with my exercise. I mean, vegetables, they're so wrapped up in the fiber, I don't worry about that. But fruits, things like that, some dark chocolate that I eat, I put that stuff around when I'm going to exercise, either right before or during or right after I exercise. And otherwise, I'm pretty low carb. I don't qualify for ketosis ever, you know, except maybe during long exercise. But in order to get this fat burning part of my metabolism going and keeping it going, I do intermittent fasting. So I'll do, and it varies. It's at least 12 hours every day. Sometimes it's 16 hours a day. And then one day a week, I'll do a 24-hour fast, you know, from dinner to dinner. I won't eat, just one day a week. And really, after having done the keto, which really only lasted for me for like 6 months, that changed my body. It changed my sense of hunger. I really don't ever get hungry anymore, even though it's been years since I did that. So doing these fasts is no problem for me, but it forces my body into burning fat, and then eating the carbs gets my body to go back to burning carbs and replenishing my glucose in my muscles when I've used it up. And I could have just done that without the CGM. So, I mean, did I really need the CGM? Could I have known that I was addicted to those stupid bars? Should I just not eat things that come in wrappers? You know, yes, probably in all cases. And maybe the CGM just was a habit breaking or habit making fast loop that you were talking about. What do you think?
Exactly. I was just going to say that. I think that's a really good example of that. Because when you're relying on your kind of own intuitions, you can be biased, but it's very difficult to, look at a spike, a huge glucose spike that is putting you into pre-diabetic ranges to take that into consideration. So I think with the way you're thinking about it is exactly right. And the way I think about it myself, it's kind of a tool that we can use to help us go into that metabolic flexibility that is probably where we want to be. Another thing is not just identifying what foods spike your glucose, but it's also as a kind of an early warning sign to see if your glucose variability is going getting worse. So that's where kind of long-term use of CGM might be helpful. And a short-term use of CGM is good for kind of, knowing what spikes your glucose. And as you said, you can probably do that just using glycemic indices. So your glycemic index, every food plot it on a glycemic index, which gives you an indication of how fast it raises your blood glucose. You can do that for most foods, but the problem with that is some combinations of foods that you can't predict, and one of them would be your protein bar. You probably won't be able to plot that correctly on your glycemic index, and that's where a CGM comes into play. But then for long term use, it's probably less useful. But if you're really into your data, you could measure your average glucose variability. And if that is getting worse over time, then that can give you an indication that something's going wrong. And then that's where it can be useful.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's good.
I mean, and we know this from studies from looking at glucose variability, where they looked at different groups of people. So they looked at people with diabetes, people with metabolic syndrome without diabetes, and then people who are healthy. And you see a continuum of worse glucose variability, even though average glucose was unchanged.
So that's what defines those, the variability rather than the average?
Well, I won't say it's defining. It's just a different metric. So it's an independent metric.
Okay. But you had earlier said it was an early warning signal.
Yeah. So you would see a higher fluctuation in blood glucose before you'd start seeing an increase in your average blood glucose.
Yes. Yes. Well, that makes sense.
That's where it's an early warning sign, but it's also kind of a different metric that you can look at, even if you keep your blood glucose average stable.
Right. You know, and shoot, who hadn't heard taking a walk after dinner is good for your digestion? Well, guess what else it's good for? It really keeps the blood sugar spikes down.
Yeah, yeah. That's grandmother's wisdom, right?
Yeah. Anybody who's looking for metabolic health and they've got any kind of worry about blood sugar, walk. Do a lot of walking. Walk after you eat. It's going to really make a difference in these spikes. That was my personal experience with the CGM.
Absolutely, absolutely. I literally just wrote an article about walking.
Great.
And I totally agree.
Well, great. What else? We've talked about sleep, which is the big gorilla in the room for so many things, athletic performance, for longevity, for your health. We talked about metabolic stuff. What else could we have some actionable stuff, like mitochondrial health or gut health or hydration?
I think the big one here would be, I mean, exercise, right?
Okay.
You can use wearables. I think that's the biggest use case for wearables is either giving you kind of short-term or immediate feedback on your exercise level and intensity, and then you can see long-term trends. It's all about looking at kind of short-term changes and long-term changes in most of these metrics.
Yeah.
And some of them are better for in different categories. So for exercise, for example, I would be looking at estimated VO2 max, which is something that you can get from Apple Watch. And it's pretty accurate when compared to real VO2 max. It's not that bad.
I don't have an Apple Watch, so I don't know what this is. Does it make you do a test and then it's tracking something, or is it just estimating it from like everyday life?
It's estimating it from your exercise. So when you exercise, it kind of starts estimating it. And it's, you know, complex algorithms, all of that. But it's not bad. It's not you'd be better doing the actual test. And especially if you want to see long-term changes. But it's not a bad estimate.
Glenn, did you say you were shaking your head? Do you have an Apple Watch, and is that tracking your VO2 max?
It does. Yeah, well, I have three Apple Watches. That's why I'm kind of...
Oh, okay. What was your experience?
It works great. I mean, I don't really check it that often, but it works quite well because it was tracking my breath. It was tracking my heart rate. It was tracking my VO2 max. It was tracking my my heart rate variability, my pulse, and everything else. You know, just I had to be careful because if I run it on full power, it drains the battery for the end of the day. That's there anything bad about it.
Yeah, so. Yeah. But as far as the VO2 max, would you say it was pretty accurate?
Well, let's take a look at it and see what it says. Right
here. Yeah, I mean, VO2 max is one of them, but the more accurate measurements from these devices are resting heart rate. It's a pretty good one, and it can be quite useful. Maximum heart rate, if you want to reach that, and you know, you can measure that, and also heart rate variability, which is a bit of a different metric than the rest because it reflects a different aspect of health, but put all together, I think these can give you a pretty good estimation of where you are. So we can talk about those separately.
Yeah, so let's dive into those because I'm really familiar with resting heart rate, and a low resting heart rate for an athlete is a good sign. Of course, every time I get my heart tested by my doctor, they say, "Why is your heart rate so low?" But anyway, tell us what we can learn from these things because I think most people... Anybody who has these devices knows what their resting heart rate is, and they probably exercise hard enough, occasionally enough, to know what their maximum heart rate is. And they probably are getting HRV. In fact, most people I know are tracking their HRV, and they're not doing anything with it because they don't know what to do with that information. But what should they do?
As you said, with this resting heart rate, and as you said, a low resting heart rate can reflect two things. It can reflect better fitness levels, but it can also reflect less stress. So when we're less stressed, your average heart rate would be a bit lower, or would be closer to your actual resting heart rate.
Okay.
If you're stressed, your heart rate is going to go up. But a better measure of stress is heart rate variability, which is kind of the measure of how much your heart rate, the time between different beats varies from one beat to another.
Right.
Where does this come into play when we're talking about physical activity? HRV reduces with age. So we do see kind of a good correlation between age and HRV. So the problem with this is that in Whoop data, for example, Whoop measures deep sleep HRV, and we have a good trend of how deep sleep HRV tracks with age. But Aura, this is one of my problems with Aura, is that the HRV seen on an Aura ring isn't really, it's a kind of an average of your HRV during the night. So it might be a good reflection of your actual heart rate variability, but the problem is they haven't shared any data, age-related data, so it's, you can't really use it to plot yourself compared to other people.
The data is there. I can tell you, because it shows me a chart of my HRV throughout the night that would match up with the sleep stages. So if somebody had access to the data, they could pull out just the HRVs in the sleep stages.
Yeah. No, I mean, I'm just saying that Aura has shared, Whoop has shared the data. Aura hasn't shared the data. And the problem is that their own, the way they do it is, it's not really, you can't find any a separate data set to compare to, because Whoop tells you we're measuring RMSSD, which is like HRV, in deep sleep. So if you find a separate data set that have done that already, you can compare that. Aura takes, they have their own proprietary kind of average during the night.
Okay.
Anyway, that's kind of neither here nor there.
And the HRV is a little different in that, you know, you can kind of compare resting heart rate between people, but you can't really compare HRV between people. You sort of have to just look at your own HRV over time. Is that right?
Yes. But I think you can. I know that people say that, but I think when you look at different people, there is a bit of a correlation there. It depends on it depends on the age. So for example, the correlation between HRV and physical fitness reduces with age. So a higher HRV compared to your peers when you're younger is probably gives you information that your physical fitness is higher.
Okay.
When you're older, not really. So that's where the difference is.
Oh, bummer. Because my HRV is pretty good, but I'm older. So.
Well, no. I mean, that's also a good thing, because it does show, I mean, you probably don't have your historical HRV data, so you can't really compare it to your previous self. But I think there is still a correlation there. It's not as good as when you were younger.
Oh, okay. Awesome.
And it's one of those things where if it's low, it's bad. If it's high, we don't know if it's high or bad, if it's good or bad.
Yeah, I had always heard, and I shouldn't say always, when I first learned about HRV, I understood that higher and lower were bad, and it was sort of in the middle that was good. But lately, the devices always seem to say higher is better. What is true about that?
Well, higher, just, I mean, what does it mean? It just means that if your HRV is higher compared to your previous HRV, that means that the balance between your sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system is healthier, which means your stress levels are lower. But it doesn't give us any indication to whether this stress is coming from a good source or a bad source, is beneficial to us or not, because it's measuring kind of physiological stress, but that can be anxiety, but it can also be a good bout of exercise. So you need to always correlate that to what is the acute cause of the change in HRV.
Okay.
Consecutive days of good HRV is not always a good thing, because you could be on a beach, having a good time, but you're not exercising at all, and you feel really good and your stress levels are low. That's giving you a good HRV. But you know, maybe you should be getting some stress in the form of exercise, fasting, etc.
Oh, that's a good example. Yeah. Because maybe in the, because the HRV is a really short-term measure, whereas fitness is maybe kind of a lagging. Fitness is important to your longevity and to your health, but you need stress in your life in order to be fit.
Exactly. And that's where kind of the short-term measure of HRV can give us an indication if we're putting too much stress on ourselves or if we're not getting enough stress.
Okay. All right. We're going to run out of time here. So I wanted to wrap up with, what's your advice to people? Where, you know, where should they focus their, as far as wearables is concerned, where should they focus their effort, their money to get the biggest bang for their buck? And I realize it's all going to be individual. It's going to matter on what their goals are and whatever their situation is. But if we just sort of said a person who's generally fit, they're older, they have the kinds of issues that a generally fit older person has, you know, maybe their sleep isn't as good. It's not terrible, but it's not as good as it used to be. They're, you know, they've been compensating with their diet because they know that they're not as healthy as they were because they're not as young as they were. And so they're trying to eat better, but maybe they're not eating as, they still eat some junk food. They still drink some alcohol. They maybe drink too much caffeine. Where do you think the lowest hanging fruit generally lies for this older athlete audience?
I think the Oura Ring, especially the new generation, is pretty good. It gives you some of the data that a wide section of the population would benefit from. Whoop, the new Whoop as well, is pretty good. I haven't tried it myself, but it seems to be a big improvement from the previous one.
Okay.
And the reason why I'm recommending these devices is they seem to have the highest accuracy. And not only that, they also have published some reassuring validation studies.
Okay.
The problem with many of the devices on the market is they make claims, but we can't really validate them. Okay. But when you have peer-reviewed published studies, that gives you an indication that these guys are serious and what I'm looking at actually reflects what's going on.
Sure. And the CGM, maybe if they could, if they want to just try it for a month or two and just to get a sense of their own body, is that something that you think is worthwhile?
I think it's worthwhile, even for non-diabetics or people who don't have diabetes. Now, there's no clinical data to show that there is improved health outcomes in people who don't have diabetes and using a CGM. But I think for a general audience, or for, I mean, your audience, they are probably the type of people who would benefit from getting these kind of insights.
Yeah.
For the general population, it's probably still not beneficial yet because there's an education problem as well. One of the things that doctors worry about in prescribing CGMs is you're only looking at one variable, with it, which is blood glucose. So that might make you eat worse foods that are higher in calories, and but that come from different sources from other than glucose.
Oh.
Or carbs.
Right. So you optimize on a subset of the data.
Exactly, yeah. So you want to combine the measurements you get from CGM with a good knowledge base of what these spikes mean and what are the best substitutes for foods that give you big spikes. And that's where kind of help of a coach could be beneficial, or your healthcare provider, or you can just be old-fashioned and do your own research.
Yeah. And you had referred to this sort of like habit building, getting these short feedback cycles. I'm pretty familiar with that. And I would say that really is the most important. This is my opinion. I think it's the most important thing about these wearables and even the CGM is that you get these really rapid, you get this tracking and you get this rapid feedback. And so you know, everybody has had the problem of intending to do things that are good for them, that are going to be healthy for them. And then they just end up not doing it. Not because they changed their mind. It was never the right time. Or it wasn't the right time often enough. And they sort of are doing battle with themselves to try to actually behave in the way they really want to behave.
Yeah, it's about self-experimentation and experimenting and seeing what works and what doesn't. And, you know, you can always The good thing about the wearables is what I like about them is you can see the effect of your experiments that you try on yourself. So if I start a new behavior and I don't see any improvement in my metrics, then that gives me really solid feedback that what I'm doing isn't really helping.
Great. That's fabulous. Adam, thank you very much. Is there anything else you want to offer to our audience here? And then would you also please tell our audience how they can find you or your company so that they could follow up with you if they wanted to?
Thanks, Joe. Thanks for having me. This was a great conversation. And I love listening to you guys nerd out about all of these topics. Yeah. I'm on Twitter, Dr. Adam Batt. That's my handle. And it was great talking to you.
Yeah, I wish we had 10 hours, not 1 hour, because you are the holder of the things that I am most interested in. But thank you for the hour, Adam. I appreciate it. You have a great day.
Take care.
Thanks for listening into my discussion with Dr. Adam Patena. His refreshingly clear thinking and unvarnished advice about biometric tracking was a huge help to me, and I hope to you. If you'd like to know more about Dr. Patena, be sure to check out the show notes at wiseathletes.com. And while you're there, you can sign up to take a free fitness practices assessment, send us a question to address on the podcast, see all of our episodes, subscribe to our podcast, and you can sign up for our newsletter. If you are on social media and enjoyed this episode, please post about it. That'd be a great help. Thanks again.